Hi, this is Tony Bruschi, host of The Grave Talks, the show you're about to listen to. We're very excited about getting this show off the ground, but we can only do it with your support. And that means letting other folks know that this show is out there and exists. And in exchange for doing that, I'm going to give you a special gift. Okay, so what I need you to do is go to the show's podcast page on whatever platform it is you're listening to. So look up The Grave Talks and Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, whatever it may be that you download podcasts on, and leave us a positive review, some stars, some nice words. That would be tremendously helpful. And press subscribe. Once you do that, email me, okay, Tony, T-O-N-Y, at thegravetalks.com. When you do that, I will send you an exclusive extra episode of The Grave Talks, one that has not yet been released publicly. You will get it and get to experience it before anybody else. That's in exchange for your support of the show and being one of the first people on board, letting other people know that we exist. Okay? That is in exchange for your 5 minutes of leaving a positive review and subscribing. So do that. Thank you so much. Let's get this thing off to a great start. And I can't wait for what the future holds of The Grave Talks. Thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the White Hill Mansion. In 1757, Robert Field inherited a piece of property from his father, who was a successful merchant. He built a comfortable mansion on the property. And then in 1765, Robert married Mary Peel. He then drowned under mysterious circumstances, January 29th of 1775. As a widow, Mary lived in the White Hill Mansion throughout the Revolutionary War. It was through her cunning intelligence that the property survived. In 1797, Mary signed over the property to her son, Robert III, who ended up losing the entire property due to mismanagement in 1804. The mansion then changed hands many times, occupied by inventors, doctors, a state senator. In 1923, it was opened as an upscale German restaurant, often visited by New Jersey's elite. In 1972, the restaurant was sold, and then sold again, and then was set to be demolished. That's when someone stepped in. The White Hill Mansion is currently in the New Jersey State Register of Historic Places, and a restoration project has been going on since 2004. Two archaeological digs have been conducted on the property, with over 30,000 artifacts being uncovered, several building foundations, and evidence of Native American occupation on the property. In addition to the artifacts and its very storied history, there are also spirits residing within the walls and in the property of the White Hill Mansion. Today on The Grave Talks, we're talking about the White Hill Mansion with Loretta and Dawn, one an investigator and another a caretaker of the property.
Okay, the property was part of what they called the tents. Back in 1680, it was a Quaker purchase. They purchased some land and they divided it up into what they called tenths, and they sold different people a tenth of the property. It wasn't a tenth of New Jersey, it was just a tenth of a town. And the first owner's name was John Snowden. He purchased White Hill in 1682. When he purchased the property, it was farmland, and he had a tenant farmer on the property in a little tenant house called an Earthfast house, which during one of our archaeological expeditions, we found the foundation to it. The property changed hands twice before it came into the Field family. And it was just a rental property at that time. And then Robert Field bought the property in 1722, and he put the first, I guess you would say, permanent house on the property, because the tenant house was taken down after that, and that wasn't really a permanent structure anyway. And we believe that he used some of the wood from the 1862 house in the 1723 house, because we see some pillars there that look like, or some beams that look like they've come from a much earlier structure. And the Field family had the house until 1804.
The Fields being one of the most prominent families owning the land and the manor in its beginning days, through three generations.
All named Robert Field. The first Robert Field, as I said, he built the house, and I believe he built the mansion part also. And at that time, there were two buildings. It was a small house and a bigger house. His son, also named Robert, became a very wealthy businessman. He had several businesses he was running from the property. He was a merchant. He owned a tavern and a furry business and just a bunch of other businesses. He would be murdered in 1775 by a British spy. His son, who would eventually take over the property in 1797, unfortunately, he's the one that joined the two buildings and made one grand mansion out of it. But he took out a lot of loans to do this and couldn't pay them back. So the whole property went up for share sale.
Death by a spy. An untimely death for a prominent man in the area.
The second Robert Field, the second generation Robert Field, was, as well as being a businessman, he was a Quaker. And he was also what the British would call an agitator. Because being a Quaker, he wasn't going to take up arms. But being a businessman, he was... He was convincing people to boycott English goods and not pay their taxes. And he even was head of writing a letter campaign to King George to say, we're not paying your taxes because they're not fair. He went out to a meeting one night in a boat, and he was going to Bucks County, which is directly across from Fieldsboro, directly across the river. So he took a boat called a slip, but the slip couldn't go all the way to shore because the water got too shallow. So from the slip to shore, he had to be rowed by canoe. And when it was time for him to come back, the manservant returned with the canoe, and the captain said, well, where's Mr. Field? And the manservant said, I don't know, he was in the boat when we left. Well, what happened was, because I've read a couple of newspaper accounts of this, the man kept changing his story. First he said, I don't know what happened to him. Then he said he was drunk, and somebody said, well, Mr. Field was a Quaker, he didn't drink. I doubt if he was drunk. And then the man said, oh, he fell overboard and I tried to pull him back, but he sunk. Well, when his body washed up, he had a big gash in his head and water in his lungs. He had drowned. And then the general thinking was that the manservant was actually spying for the British and murdered him, even though the coroner still called it an accident. That's a lot about the politics that were going on at the time when he was killed. But generally, people felt that this man murdered him.
A man murdered, and a woman turned into a widow. What happened with her life?
At the time, the Fields owned about 600 acres, and they had all of these businesses. And they had, at that point, had six children. Three of them had already passed away. They died between birth and the age of two. The seventh child, Mary, was actually carrying when her husband died. So he died in January of 1775. The last Robert Field was born in April that year. And Mary just kept the businesses going and kept the property going. And then the war started in 1776. And at that time, she would be visited by just about everybody that was involved in the war. She had the colonial soldiers that would show up on her property, and actually some of her writing talks about them coming to dinner at her house. But then after that happened, the British came to her door and accused her of harboring, because I mean, they were rebels at the time. We were still a British colony. We weren't independent yet. So I mean, harboring these soldiers that were rising up against the crown was illegal. It was treasonous. You could be hung for it. And she essentially told them, I'm not harboring anybody. This is not my war. Go away. Leave me alone. And they did leave, but one soldier did break in her house and actually run up her back steps. And there's a letter that she wrote to her sister that talks about the young man with his bayonet affixed poking open all the doors and scaring mother almost to death, because Mary's mother was living with her at the time. And she convinced him that she was not harboring soldiers, and he left, although we firmly believe that she was. Because her second husband was actually a captain in the American Navy. So anyway, after the British left, 4 days later, the Hessians would show up. And the Hessians actually came to her door early in the morning, and a Captain Rendon knocked on her door and said, my men are actually camped in your apple orchard here, and I'd like to make your house my headquarters. And Mary essentially said to him, do I have to do this? And he said, no, you don't have to, but if you don't, we'll burn your house down. So she let him stay. Smart woman. So anyway, they would stay there until, they'd stay there for 2 weeks. And this was just before Washington crossed the Delaware and took Trenton. And they were there until Washington crossed. And then they got in trouble for being there because they weren't supposed to be there. They were supposed to be in Trenton. And then they left. But Mary had a lot of activity out at her house during the all throughout the war. Always, you know, people coming and going. She ended up with 3 protection orders from everybody, from the colonials, from the British, and from the Hessians. So, and then eventually she would, as I said, remarry in, I think she remarried in 1779. She married Captain Reed. They lived there until he died in 1788. And then in 1797, she turned the house over to her son and went to live with her daughter in Princeton.
And then the third of the generation took up care of the property.
Well, that's when he had married a woman named Abigail Stockton. Abigail's father was Richard Stockton. He signed the Declaration of Independence. The third Robert was your typical living off of daddy's money kind of a guy. He never really worked. And he got this great idea to, as I said, the house was originally a huge house and a smaller house in the back. He got this idea to modernize it. And, you know, he wanted his social standing to rise. So he created this great house. He joined the two buildings. But in order to do that, he took out a lot of loans that he could not repay. So 7 years after he started his grand project, he lost everything. He lost the house. He lost the property. He lost 600 acres. It all went to sheriff sale. And as a result, well, what happened was, as I said, Abigail was a Stockton, and they were very prominent people. So to save his sister from disgrace, her brother, Richard Stockton, bought the house and I think it was 64 acres and let them live there. And the rest of the property went to a gentleman named Jonathan Ray, who was a lawyer, who then laid out what today is Fieldsboro, and he sold the property off in lots. So they lived there until Robert died. It was 1815 when he died. He actually died in Mississippi. He was down there visiting family, and he got sick and he died. Abigail would go back to Princeton and live with her family, and then the house would just continually change hands for the next, 100 years, until in 1922 when the restaurant went in.
The time period where it was changing hands year after year, some very interesting characters calling the manor home.
Around 1832, there was a gentleman there. His name was David Bruce. He was in the printing business, and he actually invented a typesetting machine in the attic of the house, along with a couple of the typefaces that we still use. It was a stylized Times New Roman and Helvetica and a few others that he actually invented in the attic of the house. There was a senator that lived there, and he was actually a field. He lived there. Well, actually, he didn't actually live there. He owned the house from about 1845 till about 1865, I think. But I don't think he was living there. I think it was sort of a boarding house at that time. And I think at one point, according to some of the documentation we have, it could have possibly been like a rest home for soldiers returning from the Civil War. Another doctor that lived there, his name was Dr. Ingersoll. He was a psychologist who had a facility in Corning, New York this was 1875. And it was a sanatorium he had up in Corning, New York it was for wealthy white women who were suffering from an anxiety that they couldn't understand. And his treatment involved them getting in touch with their sexuality. He said it was their God-given right to enjoy sex, and they were always told that they weren't supposed to. And the thing I read about him is it said that these women were having fainting spells, and they were too ill to get out of bed, and they went to his facility and came out feeling much better. So,
Sounds like unconventional therapy, to say the least.
In 1885, there was a gentleman there named Joseph Mayer who was very big in the pottery industry, and he actually put a kiln in the basement of the house. And he was developing different types of glazes and potteries and getting all kinds of patents for them and what have you. He would sell the house in 1895 to the Crossley family. And Archibald Crossley was the last baby born in the house, and he would go on to be the father of the public opinion poll. You know, those delightful calls you get at dinner time that, you know, asking you what kind of cereal you eat. You know, just very annoying. Anyway, he actually developed that. And he did actually predict a couple of presidential wins. He was very, very well known in that field. They sold the house in 1914 to someone named Susanna Graham, who we have no idea who she is. Even the family doesn't know. And they sold her the house for $1, which was very strange. And from 1914 to 1922, the house actually sat abandoned. However, there are two tunnels under the house, and people got in through the tunnels and were just engaging in all kinds of illegal activity in the house during that time, including prostitution. There was a brothel being run out of the mansion. And in 1922, along came the Glenk family, and they bought the house, and they put the restaurant in there. And their grandson still lives on the property in a small carriage house next to the mansion. And I was talking to him about his grandfather buying the house, and he said, well, when his grandfather bought the house, he wanted to know what all the beds were doing in there. And that's how they found out there was a brothel being run out of there. So, and then, this isn't even all of it. It's like the house is on. So many things happened there. There was some mafia activity that we've heard of a couple of times. There was some question as to how Mr. Glenk, who was a German immigrant who worked in a cafe in Trenton, got the money to buy the house. One of the first things he did was to put a bar in the basement during Prohibition. And he opened his bar in 1923 and got arrested in 1924 for running alcohol along the river, so the Delaware River. So we're not quite sure. We know he went to prison for a short while and came out and continued to run his illegal bar in the basement of his restaurant. So I don't know what that's all about. But we think there might have been some mafia ties with that. I asked, again, the grandson, John, about it, and John's response was he asked his grandmother about it, and his grandmother said she would take that story to her grave, and she did, so we're not sure what went on. And then throughout the restaurant, the Glenks owned the restaurant until 1972. Then from 1972 to 1977, there were five local businessmen that operated the restaurant and really kind of ran it into the ground. And then from 77 to 91, another family, the Zuzek family, ran the restaurant. And then in 1991, there's a chemical company next door to the restaurant, and they ran into some problems with their chemicals seeping into the soil. So the government kind of got on them about that. So instead of cleaning the soil, they bought the restaurant and closed it down. And they had it until 99, and then the borough bought it. The borough, Fields Borough, bought it. They own it now.
Through all the time and all those families and all those lives going through the doors of the manor, were there any reports of paranormal activity in any of that time window?
Well, this is an interesting little tidbit. The people that lived there from 77 until 91, the woman, when we started our investigations and what have you, she swore nothing strange ever went on there. So we were talking to John again, the grandson, and I said to him, I forget her name now. Anyway, you know, that she claimed nothing strange ever went on. And he said to me, so she didn't tell you about the fireplace tools? And I said, no, she said nothing ever went on. Apparently, one night, there's a fireplace in their bedroom. And they had, you know, the regular tools you usually had next to the fireplace, and they were by the fireplace when she went to bed, and she woke up the next morning and they were across the room. So I don't know, I guess she was just denying it, but she swore nothing strange ever happened. But that's pretty much all. I mean, that's all I take that back. I was going to say that's the only activity I heard of, and that's not true. We were having an event one time, and this gentleman came up and said that he was the son of one of the men that owned the restaurant in the 70s when the five local men were running the restaurant. Anyway, he told me this story. He said to me, "Did you ever hear the story about the room in the attic?" And I said, "No, what happened in the attic?" He said, when they were children, like on a Friday or Saturday night, they would go to the restaurant because their parents were working there, and they would go up in the attic and watch television. Now, in the front room, there's a socket, you know, for a light bulb, but they had an adapter in there, and they had like three plugs in there in the adapter, and they had two lamps, and they had a television set, and they were sitting there, and they were watching TV. And he said, all of a sudden, one of the lamps went out, and they noticed that the plug came out of the socket, and they didn't think anything of it. They thought it wasn't in right. He said, then all of a sudden, the light on the other side did the same thing. Plug came out, light went off. He said, now that got their attention, and they're all staring at this fixture, trying to figure out what's going on. And he said, with that, the plug from the television set, it was like somebody yanked it out of the socket. He said it actually hit the wall behind him. He said, you never saw eight kids run so fast. So he said, after that, no one would go up to the attic by themselves. And then he had his sister with him. And he said to his sister, tell him what happened to you. And his sister, who is now a grown woman, mind you, and is like, I don't like to think about it. I don't talk about it. I can't tell you what happened. So he finally got it out of her. Apparently, when she was a little girl, she was coming down the steps from the second to the first floor. And she said she was sort of skipping along. Actually, her brother told me most of the story because I couldn't get her to talk about it. And he said all of a sudden there was a man coming towards her up the steps in a pinstripe suit. And it frightened her because she didn't know who he was. And she stopped and she stared at him and he disappeared. And I mean, this woman who was probably in her 50s at the time wouldn't even look at me. She's like, I don't like to talk about that. I'm like going to pretend it never happened. So those are a couple of the stories we heard from people that had some experiences there at the house.
In 2004, the restoration project of the manor began. What was it like walking into such an old building?
At the time, honest to God, there are times I walk in there and think, why did I ever decide to do this? What was I thinking? Good Lord. But at the time when I started the preservation project, the mayor at the time was a hoarder and a really shady person, to tell you the truth. And when I went in the house, there was any manner of junk in there. I can't even tell you. There were gas grills and refrigerators and dishwashers and just all kinds of stuff. Because what this guy would do, and I can't tell you why he did this, but now Fieldsboro is a very small town. There's 500 people in it. When somebody would move out of their house, if they left anything behind, he would take it. And he'd bring it over to the mansion and store it there. So, I mean, there was so much crap. There was furniture. There were clothes. Oh, I can't even tell you. There was so much junk. And then, like I said, there was peeling paint, and there was just, wallpaper. And in the second floor, the one bedroom, the window had broken, and this vine had just grown right through the window and attached itself to the ceiling. It just was growing up the ceiling when I first started.
And rodents. Yeah. Many rodents.
Skeletons of rodents. Yes, in the attic.
Almost like an episode of Hoarders.
Yes, it was. Well, actually, what happened is the mayor passed away. And I swore to everyone I had nothing to do with his death. He did it on his own. I didn't kill him. Because he just gave me so much trouble. And what we did, as soon as that, he passed away, the new guy, who's a really nice guy, he wanted to get rid of all the junk in the house. He supports us 100%. He's behind this project, thank God, because we couldn't do it without him, to tell you the truth. He told the family of the old mayor they had X amount of days to get. They were claiming that they owned the house. They said they had some kind of lease on it, and, you know, he's like, well, fine, produce the lease. Well, they never did. So he got the keys back from them and told them, get the stuff out of the house or it's all going in the trash. So they did come and take a lot of that stuff. I don't know what they did with it. I don't know what happened to it. But a lot of the stuff, you know, whatever was left, we just ditched. I mean, we just got a dumpster, threw a lot of stuff out.
What was it like going into the building for the first time to experience paranormal activity or seek it out?
Don, do you want to tell him what happened when you first showed up at the house?
Well, the first time I was in the house was in 2010, and my ghost group had called the old mayor and asked if we could just come and hang out and check the house out. And he was kind enough to give us a tour and said, have fun, and he just left. And we started getting activity. We weren't even set up yet. We heard disembodied voices on the stairway. We got disembodied voices in the basement. There was a gigantic bang on the second floor. And this was all within the first hour that we were there. I've fallen in love with the house, and I had always wanted to get involved into a restoration project. And on the sideline, kind of study a haunted house over time. Are the hauntings consistent? You know, are they fluke things? Is it something you can control? Is it something that happens over and over again? So I was curious in that way, too. And I kind of became like a groupie to the group. And every time White Hill Mansion was at a history event, I just kind of showed up and said hello. Until finally they said, you want to just come to a board meeting? So I was like, sure, you know, why not? So I wound up proposing a deal to the board of having paranormal groups come in and rent the property for a couple hours and basically let them do what I do. And at first they said that, you know, I was nuts. And I think one board member said, well, I don't believe in ghosts. And I said, well, you believe in money because that's what I'm trying to do for you. And so it took a while, but eventually, you know, we started having groups in. And the first time I had met Loretta, I invited her to come on a ghost hunt with my group because she said we were nuts. She says, I've been here 8 years. I've never had anything happen. And so I said, well, seek and you shall find. So let's see what happens. And a couple of things had happened where I think halfway through the investigation, Loretta looked at me and she goes, I'm done. I want to go home.
I did not.
It took her a while to come around to it. But she's had many things happen to her on tours also. I know there are times that I'm giving a tour through the house where I'll have weird things. You don't even have to go on a ghost hunt. I had a necklace pulled off of my neck in the middle of a tour right in front of 15 witnesses. And I just kind of kept talking and pretended nothing happened until one of them said, what just happened? I'm like, I don't know. But I was in the attic one time giving a tour, and one of the ladies said to me, what's it like to ghost hunt? And I said, well, you know, basically you just sit in the dark and ask questions and see what happens. And she goes, can we try it? I said, all right, sure. So we asked a couple questions and nothing happened, and we're just getting ready to leave. We were in the brothel area of the house. And a long, drawn-out breath, we both heard right between us. And she looked at me, and she said, okay, I'm done. So we started walking out of the attic. But while we were walking out of the attic, whatever breathed between us was still talking in my ear the whole time. And I'm trying not to freak out my tour, so I'm just kind of like, you know, pushing it away from my ear, like, not right now. You know, go away. So, but I've had many, many things happen, so.
She finally got me to admit that when I used to go in there by myself after I told her she was crazy, one particular room, I always felt like somebody was watching me to the point where I turned around a couple times and thought somebody would be there, and there was never anybody there. But I've had... Well, then again, I wasn't spending extended periods of time in the house at that point, but once we started doing this and doing a lot of cleaning and doing a lot of, you know, trying to get the place so that we could bring people in... A lot of stuff start happening, like more stuff start happening. We start hearing things, doors opening and closing and footsteps and voices. And I had a conversation with a guy who died in 1788 in the hallway. So.
Tell us how that conversation went.
Well, I was with another group And I was still at the point where, like, you people are nuts and you don't know what you're doing, and there's an explanation for all of this. And she said, well, just ask some questions. All right. So I said, what's your name? Why are you here? Do you live here? Do you work here? And she had a recorder, and she said, well, let's see if we got anything. I'm like, sure, whatever. So we went in the other room and played it back, and I said, what's your name? And we heard a voice say, Thomas. And I said, did you live here or work here? And you hear a voice say, I lived here. And then it kind of faded, but I think I said, why are you here? And he said, I like it. But I couldn't tell what he said after that because he really faded. But what's really strange about it is that was a good, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. Last September, I had a group come in and went, and I told them that story. And at the end of the night, the leader of the group said to me, come here, I want you to hear this. And he played back his recorder. He had done the same thing I did, stood in the same spot, asked the same questions, and got the same answers.
Now, let me ask you, when you said that you heard that voice whispering in your ear, can you ever make out audibly what is being said?
Not usually. The first time my husband and I heard a female voice on the steps, it sounded like it was speaking French. And I had called Loretta, and I had told her about it, and she said, no, nobody would have been speaking French. But then we found out later that Mary Field spoke French. So when the Hessian army was there, they didn't speak English, but they spoke French. So her conversations with the Hessians were actually in French. So I thought that was kind of an interesting bit of history. There's been many times where you're in the house and you'll hear conversations on the other side of the house. And it's almost like you hear like dinner murmur, like two people talking. I can never quite make out what they're saying. So the answer is no. I don't always understand what they're saying. Now, I was up in the attic one time with a group, and one of our volunteers is terrified of the attic. And he had turned to me and he said, I hate being up here. This attic freaks me out. And between him and I, we heard, heh, 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 heh. He turned around, he left. He goes, I'm out of here. Goodbye. So that one I heard audibly.
And there's been several other incidents in the house, including an incident involving a reporter.
We had a group, besides the reporter, there were a group of six, and they were all pretty young kids. And upstairs in the older part of the house, so it was the 1723 part of the house, there's a second story. And it's actually my favorite two rooms to investigate. A lot of people overlook that area because of the more famous attic and basement area. But I love being back there, and I get a lot of good results back there. And I think Loretta was asking the questions. And my husband and I were in the back room that's connected to the first room. And when she asked the question, were you a servant in the house? It sounded like the yeah or the yes came right in my ear. But my husband said it sounded like the yes came in his ear. But yet Loretta said she heard it in the other room too. So of course we checked.
And I heard it. Yeah, I heard it like the guy was standing right in front of me. You know, like he was just like right there. I always thought like I was going to see something because I just felt him so close to me. It's very strange.
Yeah, and considering we were in separate rooms, it was pretty strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, but we didn't get it on the recorder, did we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Oh, we did? Oh, okay. Oh, I thought the recorder didn't pick it up.
No, we have it. But the interesting thing was is that, you know, you have these people that come through from the public, and there's a big difference on wanting to know if ghosts exist and then hearing something like that on a recorder. And then facing the reality of what you just heard and having your mind try to process it. And some people think it's really cool, and other people want no part of it. I mean, as soon as that came across the recorder, all six of those said, goodbye, we're done. They didn't even get halfway through the night.
It's not just ghostly adults that haunt the manor, though. Sometimes children make themselves known as well.
We very often pick up children playing. In that room where Dawn was just talking about, I've had, usually, you know, we kind of go by what some psychics tell us. Sometimes you can get the impression whether they really know what they're talking about or not. And we've had a couple tell us that they hear children playing in that back room. And children hiding in the attic, not necessarily playing. It's more like they're frightened and they're hiding up there. As a matter of fact, when we did the paranormal lockdown, they did pick up, I don't know what that camera is, 3D camera or something, where they picked up the image of
the
little boy hiding. The Kinex, yeah, hiding under the table. A lot of times people will feel like a child grabbed their hand or tugged on their shirt, like a small child would come up and want your attention and just tug on your shirt. We do get that a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I've and never had that, any passion with any children there, but I have seen a live Facebook stream that I was at where a girl actually, you could see her arm being jerked back in the hallway. And she just went around. That was pretty cool. That was on live.
Yeah. And I know, again, back when, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
When Paranormal was there, they picked up a boy's voice saying, "Daddy, where are you?" So it could have been Samuel when Robert drowned in the river, but we had a lot of children come through that live there or just, you know, came for other reasons. I met some people who came when they were children because their mother used to clean there. And while she was cleaning, they would be playing on the steps. So we've had a lot of kids come through there. And I do think there's a lot of energy from them that's still in the house.
It sounds like a lot of human spirits haunting the manor. Let me ask you this, though. Is there anything dark that haunts any particular area of the building?
Oh, well, maybe the shadow guy in the basement. I mean, no one's ever been hurt or possessed or anything like that, but occasionally you could be taking pictures down in the basement of your friends and there'll be an extra head that'll pop in your picture. That's happened several times. We haven't been able to explain it, like, you know, kind of looking at the wall and see if there's some way. It was a trick of the camera. So we haven't figured them out yet, but I've personally seen a shadow down there. Way back in the winery in the old part of the basement. And Loretta herself.
And so did I.
Shadow.
Yeah. I saw a shadow disappear into the wall down there. I've had people tell us that there's nothing evil or dangerous in the house, but there are some spirits that were like nasty people in life. Or they're angry. They're not going to do any harm or they're not dangerous, but they're just angry. So, you know, pretty much we've been told that the house is at peace.
In the past years, an archaeological dig took place on the property. Tell us what the thought process was behind that.
Well, actually, the house is registered on it's on the State Register of Historic Places. And that's kind of a process you're supposed to go through. They give you, there's lots of rules and regulations you have to follow from the Historic Commission. So one of the first things they want you to do before you do anything is an archaeological dig to see, you know, any remnants you could, you know, have from the people that lived there in the past. And we had two of them. And the one dig that we had, the last one we had, we actually found the sidewall of one of the tunnels because the tunnels have been filled in. So you can't, they don't, there's no access to them, but we did actually find the outside of the tunnel. And we found about 30,000 artifacts, including Native American. So
let me ask you an opinion question. Why do you feel that these spirits stay with the property? Why are they all still there from so many different places and times?
My opinion is you have to visit the house and you'll fall in love with it. I don't know. I can't describe it. I know the first time I walked in there, I was completely enchanted with the house. It definitely
is something about that. Yeah. Well, I can tell you this.
When I'm dead, I think.
You what? I'm sorry. What did you say?
I'm going to go back and haunt it after I'm dead.
You're going to go back and haunt it after you're dead? Dear God, Donna. That Mary Field's second husband, his name was Thomas Reed, and he actually was from Delaware, and he actually had his own estate in Delaware. But when he married her, he decided to stay at Whitehall. Because he really just loved the house and he just, you know, loved the area and he just loved the way it sat on the river. And we have documentation that says, you know, after they got married, he chose to stay there. So I'm thinking, there must be something that is obviously drawing people back to this house, because he could have gone anywhere. He could have certainly gone, taken her and gone back to his house in Delaware, but he chose to stay at Whitehill with her. So,
yeah, and I believe
people seem to like it.
Commodore Barry mentioned the house in his biography. Is that correct?
Oh, he did. Yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah. He was a very good friend of Thomas Reed, Mary's second husband. And actually, in one instance, she's credited with saving his life, because he was coming through New Jersey on it. He lived in Reading, Pennsylvania, and he was trying to get home, and the British were chasing him. And there was a big storm when he got to Whitehill, so he went to the mansion and spent the night there. And early in the morning, one of Mary's servants came and said that the British soldiers were on their way and they were looking for him and they were going to hang him because he was, he was a rebel officer. So he left on horseback, and Mary, when the soldiers came, they said, we know he's here. Where is he? Where'd he go? And she swore up and down that he was not there, had never been there. And she said, here's keys to every house, every building and every room, and search all you want. So they started searching. And while the foot soldiers, what have you, were searching, she invited all the officers in the house, and she fed them and she gave them rum and she, entertained them for a while. And then she said to them, oh, your men must be tired and hungry. And they sat down in the apple orchard, and she sent them food and she sent them alcohol. And 4 hours went by, which gave Barry plenty of time to get out of town. And after so much time had passed, they just kind of decided, oh, we don't know where he is. And they went back to Philadelphia and they stopped looking for him. So she was, she detained them long enough so that he could get away. But he was very fond of the house also.
So what does the future hold for the Whitehill Mansion?
Hopefully it's not burned to the ground. No. By that time, I really hope that we've accomplished, all the structural things that we have to do there so that it could just be open to the public for, like I said, like a community center, someplace you could go. They're even putting a little, I think they call it a casual park next to it, which is just benches and a picnic table, and you can see out over to the river. So it'll just be someplace you might want to come and spend an afternoon. And we'll have, there is part of it that will be a museum, so you can go in and you can look. We have some of the artifacts on display. We got some furniture from the last family that lived there, the Crossley family. So these things, it will just be things you can go in and see, and then hopefully we'll have events going on at the same time that you can participate in. So within the next, 5 years at least, it's going to be a lot of fixing up and patching holes and, fixing leaks in the roof and what have you. The entire back room has to be rebuilt. But hopefully at that point we'll be almost there.
And one of our challenges is to make history fun. So just bring it in,
yes,
tours, and the history is interesting to some people, but not for everybody. So having some of these events, we hope to get younger people in and throw a little bit of history here and there and get them excited about it.
To find out more about the Whitehill Mansion, you can visit their website, whitehillmansion.com. Or follow the link on our website, thegravetalks.com. That wraps up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you listen to podcasts on. And please give us a review. Some stars would greatly help us in the ratings and letting other folks know that we exist. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.